This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. This is tape number 369, side one, December 29th, 1978. I'm sure many of you were interested in the news coverage of the JFK assassination. The headlines that broke this week, of course, it was a great source of satisfaction to me to see the front page of such newspapers as the Washington Post and the San Francisco Chronicle carrying stories about new evidence to shake up the JFK probe and the possibility that there was a second gunman at the grassy knoll. This comes just as the House Select Committee is finishing their investigation, if you can call it an investigation. They're finishing their whitewash. But it's important to take note of this article, particularly after doing 15 years of research, 15 years and 1 month to the day, that's December 22nd, 1978, the front page of the San Francisco Chronicle, the first paper I get in the morning, says, "New evidence shakes up the JFK probe." It goes on, "The House Assassinations Committee ordered an emergency hearing to study new evidence of a possible mystery gunman in addition to Lee Harvey Oswald being involved in the killing of President John Kennedy." And, of course, I called Representative Stokes in Washington and Mr. Fenton, the chief investigator for the House Select Committee, and talked with them at length and suggested that this isn't new evidence, that they, number one, had covered it up all along. There was massive evidence that a shot came from the grassy knoll, that the grassy knoll shot would be the fatal headshot, which means that Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill President Kennedy at all. And then I referred to the book, The Treason is My Daily Bread, that I talked about on tape number 346. This was August 18th, 1978. The references to this British agent named Zed, sent by Nazi Chief Martin Bormann living in Latin America. Bormann's close links, I told them, had to do with George de Morenschild and Albert Osborne and Clay Shaw and the Permandex connections. This second gunman story throws out the, as I say, the guilt of Lee Harvey Oswald as the assassin. Of course, the House Select Committee will say that the second shot went amiss and didn't hit anybody, that all the shots that were fatal came from Lee Harvey Oswald, but that won't wash either, and they're really in a mess. One member of the House Select Committee was quoted in the newspaper saying it's a hell of a mess, and Representative Harold Sawyer from Michigan said the new evidence indicates without a reasonable doubt that four shots were fired at the motorcade. I also told them to get that car out of Dearborn, Michigan. It's stored there, the one that John Kennedy drove in, and rip out the seats. It was rebuilt later for Lyndon Johnson and was used up through, I think, Gerald Ford. Rip out all the seats and look into the metal of the back and see if you can't find some traces, because the new tests say that the shot either went right next to the car within 10 feet or inside the car, and I was told that there was something inside that car that hasn't been divulged and the car hasn't been examined. I have mentioned on other tapes that Buddy Walters from the police department in Dallas had picked up a .45 shell at the grassy knoll and had turned over to the police, and then he in turn later was killed by policemen, the witness who had this piece of evidence that was not used by the Warren Commission or the House Select Committee. And the book Treason for My Daily Bread says that this particular person used a .45, and that would fit in with the evidence that was picked up at the grassy knoll. Of course, coming at this time, it is an out for the House Select Committee. They covered up the assassination conspiracy at all levels. But it's an easy out for them, because just when they're ready to give their report, they can say there's shocking new evidence and leave the door open for a conspiracy. Instead of spending the $6 million that they had in the 2 years that they had to start with this evidence and start with the conspiracy, they waited till the end and threw it in and said, whoops, we're out of money, we're out of time, our staff has already got jobs somewhere else. But the story of again, over the wire services, was disturbing new tape may show Kennedy shot from two positions. That was December 21st. The San Jose Mercury came out with the two-position story, that the gunmen were used in these locations. Later on, they tried to cover up that Kennedy was not shot from two positions, but a bullet went astray, and this is what they'll try to use in their conclusions, I suppose. The San Jose Mercury the next day had a story, tape analysis shows the shots fired at JFK from two spots. The Los Angeles Times had an article, December 22nd, new data in John Kennedy sling called significant. Now, that was put on page 7, which is interesting. The Washington Post had a large front page story. The San Francisco Chronicle had a large front page story. The Washington Post was very impressive. It begins, experts track mystery JFK bullet from grassy knoll, JFK's assassination, and it got the position it should have had considering the importance of the story. But the best sour grapes award goes to the New York Times. That's the newspaper that used their Harrison Salisbury to write an introduction to the Warren Report 15 years ago, saying that anybody who questioned the findings was mentally deranged. And it was also the New York Times that had a large section on the condensation of the Warren Report for instant acceptance, that everybody would get the final word of the Warren Report when it came out 14 years ago. So on page A16, hidden behind a lot of other news and very unimportant, the lead story is panel told of four shots at Kennedy, that a shot could have come from the grassy knoll, and that there may have been four shots, but it's a very low-key article coming from the New York Times that pushed the Warren Report so hard and made a lot of profit at it at the same time, and published an account of one of the printings of the Warren Report. They were very careful on page 16 to give it the least amount of space in terms of inches and headlines that they possibly could, and yet cover it. And of course, I call that the sour grapes. It's interesting to follow the way the media handles this kind of information after being part of the conspiracy cover-up for so many years. But as I say, the Washington Post was really upfront, just as they were in a great part of the Watergate story. They were anxious to get the news out for whatever reason, and they did cover a large story. The Assassination Information Bureau is a group of young men that was formed in the 70s, 1973-74, and had that conference in Boston in 1975 that was the beginning of the setting up of the House Select Committee. And they're located in Washington, D.C. now, and they have a newsletter. I'm giving you the address here in case you don't have it. And they have a summary, a response of 7 critics on the House Select Committee hearings. And they have an interview with Jerry Polyakov, David Lifton, Sylvia Marr, Harold Weisberg, Paul Hawk, Bernard Fensterwald, and Carl Oglesby. And next week on this tape, I'm going to do an hour analysis of the 7 critics' view of the House Select Committee hearings, because many of you who take these tapes have my analysis of and critique of the House Select Committee. And I want to go into detail the 7 questions that each one of these people were asked, as opposed to my point of view. I think it's very clear for you to understand where Mae Brussel is and how she differs from these particular critics. You see, I have accused all of these critics of of the Warren Commission, of working with the FBI, working with the War Department, the National Security Agency, the National Security Council, that each one of these people is hiding the real military operations behind the killing of Kennedy. They're hiding the Permandex connections, the international gun running, the dope dealing, the future military dictatorships that came into power. Each one of these critics was asked 7 questions. What new evidence did the House Committee develop? What mistakes or omissions did they make? What were your hopes of the public hearings? Was it doomed from the start? How did Richard Sprague compare with Robert Blakey, the first attorney that was hired? Will the JFK issue be relegated now to the past as part of history? And what are your work plans? And what I'll do next week is to take the answers given by these people, Polyakov, Lifton, Marr, Weisberg, Hawk, Fensterwald, and Oglesby, and show you their layers of cover-up, that these particular critics are selected by the AIB to keep a lid on the real story of who killed John Kennedy, and they become the next authorities, the AIB and these people, instead of the whole story coming out. Lane set up that committee and then took a powder and moved to California went on working with Jim Jones and the People's Temple and James Earl Ray. He abandoned the committee after it was set up in the hands of G. Robert Blakey. So next week, I'm going to go into what makes Mae Brussel different than these seven other people, how I vary with their answers, and, of course, what I thought about the committee is public record by my past tapes, and then you can compare it, and it'll be an interesting study of questions that are unanswered and expose the people that are still covering it up. When John Kennedy was killed and the Warren Commission was selected by Lyndon Johnson to investigate the murder of John Kennedy and Officer J.D. Tippit and Lee Harvey Oswald, he appointed a commission with persons, the names I was not familiar with. I hadn't studied much of American history. I will tell you I was ignorant up to that point. I vaguely knew some of these names, but I didn't know much about their background or what they had done. So when he appointed John J. McCloy and Earl Warren and Alan Dulles and John Cooper, Richard Russell, Gerald Ford, and Hale Boggs, I didn't know those men. I wasn't familiar with their work or who they represented in Congress or what the clients they represented as attorneys. But I knew enough then to begin a file folder called Warren Commission Members. And every time there was a newspaper article from the time John Kennedy was killed and this committee was set up, the Warren Commission, up to the present day, I would throw articles about these particular people into these files to get a profile of the men that were covering up the murder of the President of the United States and the man that was charged with his murder. And then, of course, Louis Neisser was on that list because he wrote the introduction of the Warren Report, one copy, and Harrison Salisbury was on that list. And then when you study the biography of these people, you become very sure that they were hand-selected to conceal the real truths behind the assassination. Now, the same can apply for you people who are much younger or even older, who understand the way to investigate now. Apply that to the House Select Committee on Assassinations, and I'm going to give you a beautiful example of doing research into the background of these people. I've given you on an earlier tape their names and addresses, and you can get it from other sources. Lewis Stokes, Richardson Pryor, Walter Fauntroy, Von Burke, Christopher Dodd, Henry Ford, Floyd Fithian, Robert Edgar, Samuel Devine, Stuart McKinney, Charles Thone, and Harold Sawyer. Whenever you see their names, if you're so inclined, save articles about them, and you get an overview of the possibility of how or why they could be used this time to cover up. Later, you'll find them involved in sex scandals and blackmails and payment under the table, such as Senator Talmadge is being investigated now. And a lot of scandals come up. This happened at the time of Watergate. The men in the Senate Select Committee investigating Watergate were all involved with surreptitious and clandestine activities across the board. And we have to go into the biography now of the people who covered it the second time, such as G. Robert Blakey, the chief attorney. We know that he was linked to Moe Dalitz. He was a character witness for this particular person, tied in with organized crime and assassination teams with the Hughes Empire and Robert Mayhew. And now we have to find out if G. Robert Blakey is any relative to George Philip Blakey, who I mentioned several weeks ago on the tape number 367, Blakey of British Intelligence, who set up a place to train assassins and brainwash people down in Jonestown. Is there any relationship between George Philip Blakey of the House Select Committee, not G. Robert Blakey, rather, of the House Select Committee, and George Philip Blakey from England? As I've said many times, you have to ask the most absurd questions, and sometimes you come up with some very weird and substantial answers. Now, the reason I bring that up is that Richardson Pryor was very active as chairman of the subcommittee of the House Select Committee on Assassinations here, of covering up. He was very good at covering up any important questions and playing totally dumb, even though he was a former state and federal district judge in South Carolina. As the chairman of the special subcommittee investigating the assassination of Kennedy, he was very clever. If you read their printed reports that will come out soon, you can see the quality of his questions and the evasiveness of the entire committee. But the San Jose Mercury had an interesting biography of Richardson Pryor that I think of is of interest, and I think it needs following up too, because he's looking for an important job. The lead article is Top Drug Panel Post sought by medicine fortune holder. Sans A. Mercury. It says it's from the Washington Post. The holder of a pharmaceutical fortune, Representative Richardson Pryor, and that pharmaceutical fortune is Richardson Merrill Incorporated, wants to become the chairman of the House subcommittee that oversees the drug industry. Pryor acknowledged that he has several million dollars in the drug business and that it is potentially serious as a conflict of interest if he became the chairman of the health panel of the Interstate and Foreign Commerce Committee. This is an important job that's up for grabs, and he also has to supervise bills that are related to the drug industry while holding several million dollars worth of stock in drug company. The Richardson Pryor, the Judge Pryor that was so active in suppressing information on the House Select Committee that worked with G. Robert Blakey, with his links to modalities and so forth, is the head of a family holding called the Richardson Merrill Incorporated, the subject of vast, this from the Washington Post and Sans A. Mercury, the vast controversies involving the production of A, the swine flu vaccine, B, thalidomide, C, anti-cholesterol drugs, which are now in the market just this week exposed as also being cancer-producing. He's been the subject, his company, of massive lawsuits, and he also owns stock in Sterling Drug Company, which again goes to IG Farben and the Rockefeller compound. He said he recognized that there would be a potential conflict, but this is what Richardson Pryor said. I feel I could be fair and objective. I won't do anything the committee or the House leadership doesn't want me to do. Now, that's in conflict with what we want them to do because we saw the way he ran this House Select Committee. He also is chairman of the Select Committee on Ethics, and that may explain why so little happened to the Ethics Committee in the House of Representatives. There's another man, Representative Henry Waxman, from a Democrat from California, a liberal, who wants to be head of this drug committee, and they will be having hearings on the swine flu claims and so forth. But here is a direct conflict of interest right on the House Select Committee when you're studying a gun-running assassination team that are in narcotics, smuggling of weapons, mind control programs, the use of drugs for mind control, and these mysterious laboratories of Sterling Drug and IG Farben. Here's a man who certainly is representing firms that cause people to be paralyzed, to be crippled. These unnecessary swine flus that were done through his company, Richardson Merrill and Company. And this is the kind of person, just one of those people that was on the House Select Committee doing the dangerous work of covering up the murder of the President of the United States. I gave you December 13th the new subtitles of the investigation into Guyana, and I want to talk with you now about the area in Section 4, Mind Control, number 34, Fingerprinting and UCLA in Jonestown, number 40 in that section on the doctor, Dr. Schacht, and also Section C, the conspiratorial links, number 59, having to do with the Muse Medical Institute, genetics and immunology. I talked about the UCLA school and gave you that quotation about using the secret Nike bases in California that was published in that book by the Senate investigation on behavior modification. But also in that book, on page 319, the subject of fingerprint classification came out with regards to mind control experiments. This is a quotation from the book, which I really believe had nothing to do with mind control, except there was something that the UCLA school wanted to study on the fingers of people, and how in the world would you get the fingerprints off of them and be able to peel them off unless they were dead. They had a problem which they called fingerprint classification because they said all fingerprint classifications group patterns in uniform, meaningful classes. But we have to break down these classifications and use what they called the Henry FBI classification of fingerprints and also the medico-biological classification, which are due to differences in purposes. The FBI system of taking fingerprints is intended to identify and make strict replicas for their computers and for retrieval, from the computer retrieval. But the medico-biological system is planned to be a quantifiable definer of body symmetry, to interpret genetic and medical history of an individual, and to allow analysis of population, statistics for genetic, epidemiological, and medio-demographic studies. They were to devise a system other than the FBI for biological purposes, and that was part of the mind control program that was to take place at UCLA, which was stopped in late 1973 and I believe was continued down to Jonestown. The second hurried book that came out after the massacres down there, in addition to The Suicide Cult by Marshall Kuldoff, was one by Charles Krauss called The Guyana Massacre. These both came out right within weeks after the death down there. And in the book, Guyana Massacre, on page 150, it tells about the delay in getting the bodies and the problem with taking fingerprints from these bodies. It says the stories were that inside the coffins, the decomposed bodies were awful. Limbs had fallen off. There were infestation of maggots. There was more to be done. It was necessary to identify the human remains in the containers. Prints were needed from all 10 fingers because of the absence of names or identifying documents. The prints then had to be matched with fingerprints in FBI files. Around the clock, the mortuary crews worked on the decomposition. The hands lacked firmness to make fingerprints. This forced the crews to remove the upper layer skin from each finger, slip it on their own hands over rubber gloves, and make the inked impressions. Now, this is what I tried to tell Mrs. Bouquet, whose son was killed down there, or Mr. Harris, whose daughter had her throat cut down there. Her body didn't decay, but the other family's bodies had decayed, was that they should insist on autopsies that the fingers would be slipped off of these various people, in the same way that Donald DeFries was sent from Los Angeles to Cleveland, Ohio, to be buried minus head and fingerprints. And I maintain that the bodies were allowed to rot and decay so that they could be sent to Dover, Delaware, and that they would have an excuse to work with the Hughes Medical Institute to slip the fingers off of all of these bodies and do their experiments on genetics and immunology. So it's interesting that the very first book that came out, second book that came out, on Guyana, talks about slipping the fingers off, the 10 fingers off of the bodies to remove the upper layer of skin from each finger and to go ahead and then make their impressions. And the question is, were they making impressions or did they keep the skin for those fingers for other tests? Because, as I mentioned before, they could have come in within 12 hours and identified every single body if they didn't want to use the fingers for experimentation. Also in the paper this last few weeks was a series of articles on the Hughes Empire's secret role in medical research. But I just want to share parts of that with you, which I think have to do with the San Francisco connections and the use of money that could go down to Jonestown and areas that have to be further investigated. This is by Charles Pettit from the Christian Science Monitor, but it says the intimate connections between the financial empire of Howard Hughes and the most advanced medical research in the country is now being involved with gene splicing at the University of California, in California. A lot of this was under the direction of Dr. George Thorne from Harvard Medical School. The Hughes Medical Institute was founded in 1953 with Hughes Aircraft being the sole owner. Thorne revealed the institute paid full salary of 75 scientists at 12 medical centers, including Stanford University. Now, it was Stanford Law School that sent Tim Stone up to Ukiah, where Jim Jones arrived from Brazil with $100,000 to open up his little organization there. This article says that they gave money to the University of California in San Francisco and currently has an $18 million annual budget for medical research. Some of the finest, fair, young medical researchers in the country are getting money from this support. Now, Jim Jones said that he gave money to the Shock boy, Larry Shock, for the man who administered all the cyanide and who was obviously off his rocker. The personality descriptions of people make him sound very mysterious, and his family interview, there's been one in Houston, Texas, has a lot of suggestion that the Shock story has to be gone into much, much farther. But money was put up for his medical training in Mexico, And the question is, did Jim Jones do it or the Hughes Medical Institute? They had millions of dollars in California. The Bay Area researchers are on the Hughes payroll, and they were contacted by the Chronicle. They said 2 years ago, this would be 1976, at California in San Francisco, Hughes was setting up a $4 million genetic program on the campus. They were going into genetics, immunology, and the very things that were mentioned in the UCLA book regarding fingerprinting and so forth. They're going into DNA. Remember that the Stanford research had put up a lot of money for Donald DeFries and experimentations in the SLA program. The overlapping of the SLA to the Jonestown is tremendous. I don't have time to go into all of it now, but we'll do it on various shows. But they were into genetic research, into millions of dollars in the San Francisco area. Now, Jim Jones was supposed to have had 33 babies delivered in Jonestown. They were teaching paramedics on how to deliver babies. Yet the list of people that died there and their ages, their color, their sex, were printed in the newspapers last week, a full account, and not one of those 33 babies was born. There were a group of people that left and got over to Venezuela. There was a boat that left Jonestown that went on over to Venezuela. There were people there at the time. Leo Ryan was there. The question is, what did they do with these babies? Did they deliver 33? Were they the result of genetic research, of all this money, of the Hughes Medical Institute, and the ship that left with Mr. Blakey to Barbados? Did they have any of these children or babies? These questions have to be asked because at the time Moscone died in San Francisco, Mayor George Moscone, he was on a hit list, number one to go in case the Jonestown thing fell apart. He was being investigated for having received approximately $70,000 from the Hughes organization. He had tape-recorded conversations with Terry Buford and Tim Stone, a Stanford lawyer. Mr. Freitas, the district attorney in San Francisco and the mayor of San Francisco, were tape-recorded on various conversations that could be used. And because of the heavy amount of Hughes money into medical research in San Francisco and at Stanford, and the money going Hughes money into politicians in the Bay Area, the Hughes money into genetic and immunology research, the delay in getting those fingers off, the intent of UCLA that was a recipient of CIA and Hughes money to study identically the genetic and epidemiology of people based on their fingerprints, and then the use of Dover, Delaware, which is an Army Defense Department place. The bodies could have been shipped to California. They were shipped there with the peeled fingerprints. This is a can of worms that should be gone into for a long, long time. I talked to Marshall Kilduff, who wrote the first book, The Suicide Cult, and I spoke to him just this morning about the possibility of mind control and experimentation down in Jonestown. And he said, oh, impossible. That's terrible. It's too hard to believe. I can't believe it. I reminded him that I broke the Watergate story at a press conference in Los Angeles in August 72, and none of the newspapers would carry any of the story about Richard Nixon and L. Patrick Gray and the CIA being involved in Watergate or Mullen Associates being a cover for the CIA. That took 9 months for James McCord to start speaking. But based upon my past track record of exposing various stories and so forth, these people still hold the line, and Kilduff wrote a book, The Suicide Cult, but he couldn't believe that there would be mind experimentation. He says, I'll have to talk to Mark Lane and get back to you. And, of course, you know where Lane is at. The news media will block this story. A man who wrote a book on the suicide cult just freaked out to think that there should be anything. I gave him the references here to the fingerprinting, what went on in Delaware, what was quoted in Krause's book, what UCLA wanted to do, the use money in San Francisco at the hospital in San Francisco at Stanford, and the question about this doctor that was educated, who got his scholarship from Jones, and the Jones money could have come from Stanford research, and Jones himself could have been made into that zombie in Brazil. Those are the things that are kept out of books like Guyana Massacre and The Suicide Cult. The man panicked. He never had heard of such a thing. But the evidence is there now that they did slip the skin from each finger off those bodies there, which is what I knew they were doing, and I knew that's why they were sent to Dover, Delaware. I can't emphasize enough that if you don't get the government out of the medical business, if you don't get them out of that germ control center down in Atlanta, Georgia, the one whose company Richardson Pryor makes the swine flu for, and the studying Legionnaire disease and the air conditioning plants, if you don't break up the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and make use aircraft, pay their taxes, the internal revenue, and then the internal revenue state which people get money for research, then you're going into a Dachau, Auschwitz, Treblinka concentration camp, Jonestown today, tomorrow the world. You've got to get the government out of the medical business and write to various congresspeople and call talk shows and use this material. This can't just be a little in thing between you and me. You have to do part of it to take this material and this information that I pass on to you and see that it reaches congressmen and that it get the proper exposure and not be relegated to some bizarre theory, that we break down what Jonestown was really about. Mark Lane is quoted in Krauss's book on page 111 as saying that when people were dying down there, that they were smiling and genuinely happy. And later there was a tape recording that shows that they were screaming and crying, and that now it turns out 700 people had been injected and murdered and hadn't committed suicide at all.